Like Russell said earlier, we are so incredibly excited that you are joining us, whether you're here in person or listening to our podcast, or maybe you're checking us out online for the very first time, as we embark on part three of this four-part series that's launching us into a brand new year that we are calling What's Next. And if you're here for the very first time, you're wondering what this series is all about. You see, this series revolves around this challenge, that in every single one of our lives, remaining where we're at and staying stuck isn't the best option for our lives or our future. But it's about more than just a challenge. This series is also about some encouragement and hope that better is possible. And when we embrace that challenge and we embrace that hope, it leads us to begin to see that this year was meant to be a year unlike any other. That 2021, hopefully, right, was meant to be better than 2020 in so many of our lives. But it doesn't end there. You see, we can look back into our past and we can hope that 2021 was better than 5 years ago in our lives, or 10 years ago in our lives, or better than the last half century of our lives. We all desire something better, and this could be the year in which that better actually comes to fruition. And we believe that this series has the potential to be so powerful and so relevant in every single one of our lives because we believe this one thing. That every single one of us are somewhere. You are somewhere in your marriage. I'm somewhere in my parenting. We are somewhere in our finances. We are somewhere in our health. And because we all find ourselves somewhere on this journey through life and multiple areas of our lives, if we are still breathing, it means we have not reached the destination yet. There is still work to be done. We are not finished, and we have steps forward to be taken right here, right now. Steps forward that allow us to begin to experience what Christ came to give us. No matter who you are, no matter what your past looks like, no matter what stage of life you find yourself in, Christ made it clear when he walked on this earth. My purpose is to give you a rich and satisfying life. I want you to be able to live life to the full. And what if 2021 could be the year in which our lives take a step a little closer to being rich and satisfying? In which our lives step a little closer to living fuller than what we have ever lived before? But experiencing a life like that requires us to have a vision for our future. It requires us to look down the road into our 2021s, 2022s, 2023s, at what's coming in our lives, and to begin to pursue something better. To begin to look ahead and have a vision that presses us forward towards that rich and satisfying life that we were meant to experience. But in order for us to do that, we must heed the words of a guy named King Solomon. In this passage that we've come back to, it's become the theme of this series, a passage we have come back to every single week, and we find it in the book of Proverbs, chapter 29. If you haven't done so already, this is a perfect opportunity for you to grab your weekly. It's what you got when you came in this morning. And if you crack that open, what you'll find on the inside is a notes page that we have designed specifically for you. It'll help you follow along as we move through the text. Everything will come up on the screen for you as well if that's not your style. But you can also grab a pen in the seat back in front of you, and you'll notice some blanks there that you can fill in as we move through this, some truths that you can hang on to as you struggle with that question of what's next, where do we go from here? That unlocks the door to an incredible 2021. But here is what we find King Solomon saying about the vision that we must have and what it does or doesn't do if we don't have it in our lives. Starting in verse 18, he writes this: "Where there is no vision, the people perish. Where there is no vision for your future, things start to die." And every single week of this series, we've come back and we've defined this word in the original language in the Hebrew for those of us who are here for the very first time. And that word in the Hebrew language is literally translated into a passionate pursuit of your future. When he says vision, he's meaning a passionate pursuit of your future. When we don't passionately pursue our future, the slow death begins. It's the very reason why in the medical field, death is defined as the absence of change. that when we fail to change and we just become reserved to remaining where we're at in this present stage of life, things start to slowly die. Our finances, our marriages, our parenting, they never come to fruition in the way in which we dreamt they would. But we have an opportunity to turn the corner. But turning the corner requires us to focus on taking next steps in four distinct areas of our lives. A few weeks ago, we kicked off this series by talking about this reality for every single one of us that is sometimes hard for us to grasp, that we were not created to live this life simply for ourselves, that we were actually created with a mission to make a difference. And when we make a difference in our world and beyond our world and even in the whole world, that something inside of us begins to stir, that something is ignited inside of our souls that drives us towards the rich and satisfying life that we were meant to experience. And then last week, we continued the series by talking all about discovering purpose and this reality that you were made on purpose for a purpose. And while 87% of us on this earth have yet to discover what our purpose is, it doesn't negate the fact that you still have a purpose that is waiting for you, that God is still fighting for you to discover that purpose and start to live in that purpose. And then next week, I couldn't be more excited to finish off this series by talking about this concept of knowing God. And we're talking not about knowing, not about having the Sunday school answers for those of us who have grown up in church all of our lives. We're talking about knowing God, about getting to experience a relationship with the one who created us and knows us best. And yet, if you're anything like me, in spite of that, still loves me most. That when we experience a relationship, not rules, not religion, but a true relationship, everything changes from that moment forward. But today, we're talking all about this concept, this step forward in our lives of finding freedom. And this step is so ridiculously important because what I believe about so many, if not every single one of us in this room or listening online, is that when we look back at our lives and the past in our lives, our pasts are all full of moments of hang-ups, and addictions, and regrets, and mistakes, right? And every single one of us look into our past and we see our past littered with things that force us to believe if those things wouldn't have happened in our past, our lives would be so much better, right? If we wouldn't have made that decision or gone down that path, where we presently sit would be just a little bit better than what it presently is. And because we have those regrets and we continue to look at those mistakes, we find ourselves, whether we want to admit it or not, chained to our past. We find ourselves in bondage, and I know that's a big and that's a serious word, but we find ourselves in bondage to our past and those mistakes and those regrets that keep us from moving forward into what God has designed for our future. And here's what's crazy, and this is so good. What we want you to hear this morning is this, is that you and I are permitted to begin to experience what God has already paid for in your life and in my life. There are benefits that come along with the price that our God has already paid, and my goal is to help you begin to experience those benefits in your life from this day forward. To begin to experience healing in an unattaching process to all those things in our past, our regrets, our habits, our mistakes, our guilt, our shame. But finding freedom from those things only comes when we acknowledge this one vital truth, that in our lives, true and lasting freedom is found in the cross, and it is sustained in community. True and lasting freedom, not the freedom that comes and goes and is pseudo-freedom, but the one that sticks around is only found in the cross and sustained in community. We find the unhooking from our past coming from the cross. But I wanted to make this point. Even though we're not going to camp out here for this message or for any length of time, I wanted to make sure this morning that we did not miss this. That God's original design was for him to provide freedom in our lives through the cross, but for that freedom to be maintained in the context of relationship with other human beings. That we maintain our freedom when we are a people who are willing to embrace things like authenticity and transparency and vulnerability and things that if you're men in the room, scare the living daylights out of you. But things that we are meant to embrace that bring about a maintenance of that freedom in our lives that keep those things in our past from coming back and reattaching themselves to us. It's the reason why small groups are such a big deal to us. And why 2021 is a year in which we are pumping so much time, effort, and resources into helping you understand just how vital community groups and relationships with other people can be in your pursuit of the answer to this question, what's next? But before we get to community, we must fully embrace the cross. And there's a difficulty to fully embracing the cross. And Paul, in his letter to the church in Corinth, makes it so ridiculously clear when he says some people in this world find it really difficult to understand. The cross just doesn't make sense. Check this out in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. He says, the message of the cross is foolish to those who are headed for destruction. But we who are being saved know it is the very power of God. Paul's saying here, man, to most people, the cross seems foolish. It doesn't make sense to those who haven't experienced its ability to bring about freedom in our lives from our past. But to those who have, we fully understand the power that it carries. We fully understand that it has power, power. Wonder-working? No Baptists in the room. We got no Baptists in the room that know about the wonder-working power. That the cross brings about incredible power in our lives as we head towards this future that God has for us. But the process of the cross was a process that began to take place in unhooking us almost 2,000 years ago. And the process of bringing about freedom in our lives really began on one Thursday night. See, on one Thursday evening, almost 2,000 years ago, this guy named Jesus gathered his followers, a group of guys named the disciples. And they headed to this upper room and what they thought was just a preparatory meal for the Passover that they were about to celebrate. They had all descended on Jerusalem to celebrate this Passover, something that had happened hundreds, if not thousands of years before that time and the deliverance of God. And they thought they were just celebrating that. Now we know that moment in time in which Jesus sat around that table one last time with his followers as the Last Supper. And they broke bread. And they heard him say some crazy stuff about the bread being his body and the wine being his blood. And then they got up from the table and Judas kind of scampered away into the night and the rest of them proceeded to the garden. And Jesus began to pray for the anguish that he was about to endure. And as Jesus prayed and the disciples caught up on their sleep, on that fateful evening into the garden, marched Judas with his band of Roman soldiers. And he greeted his master, his teacher, for the last 3 years with a kiss. And the Roman soldiers arrested him and dragged him back into Jerusalem. And what we know is by the time they got back into Jerusalem and they threw him down for his first trial, that Jesus, from the time of about 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. in the morning, endured six different trials between Jewish religious leaders going from Caiaphas to Annas, and then he went to Pilate, and then to Herod, and then back to Pilate, all of which, according to Roman law, was against the law. You were not allowed to try anyone at night in secrecy, but this was all done. And we pick up this account in Matthew chapter 26, and it's not in your notes, but in Matthew 26, we get this incredible account that as they throw Jesus down for each of these six trials, the Jewish religious leaders go searching for anyone willing to give false testimony. They go searching for liars and false witnesses to bring things against this man named Jesus so that they can finally get what they want, putting him to death, getting him out of the picture, because he's flipped the Jewish religion upside down. And why were they looking for liars? Because they had nothing against a perfect man to actually be able to put him to death. But then they asked this one question that changed everything. As he was in a trial, they asked him, "Are you the Christ?" And this word Christ that we just flippantly associate with Jesus, Jesus Christ, is literally translated as the anointed one who breaks bondages. Are you the chosen one who frees people from captivity? And as effectively Jesus answers yes, every Jewish religious leader flies off the rails. And in the account in Matthew 26, they literally say they tore their clothes and they began to scream. And from that moment forward, they fought tooth and nail for Pilate to finally give in to their wishes and crucify him. And after Pilate has given every excuse and he's exasperated at trying to say, "I find nothing against this man," he finally relents and agrees to have this man named Jesus be crucified. And in that one fateful moment, something that was written nearly 800 years before this moment becomes set into motion. Something that we find a man named Isaiah write in the book of Isaiah, chapter 53, verse 5. He writes this: "But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him. And by his wounds, we are healed." You see, you'll notice in your notes that I've strategically highlighted four different words. Four words that as we move through this story, take us to a place that for some of us, we have never been before. Begin to reveal something to those of us who have heard this story hundreds of times that we have never fully seen. That some of the things that Jesus endured weren't just flippant details to the story. They weren't just things that were being done to him. They were also things that were being done for us. And on that fateful day, as Pilate agrees to have him crucified, they take him out and they place him before the whipping post. And they strip his back and they begin to whip him. And for many of us, I'm going to try not to be emotional again. For many of us, we have this picture that's been painted in our mind, or maybe we look at Indiana Jones when we think of the whip, like this skinny little leather thing that's just one strand that they're like whipping him like this. And that's not actually what history tells us was done. At that time, the Roman soldiers, to proceed with this whipping, would actually use a whip that was called the cat-o'-nine-tails whip. And what it looked like was it wasn't just a singular handle. It was a handle that was about a foot long. A leather rod would protrude from that, and then there were nine strands of leather that would come from that. And each Roman soldier would pride themselves on their whip, their cat-o'-nine-tails, being the most ferocious whip that it possibly could be. And so what they would do is that from each of those nine leather strands that came out, they would attach with horsehair. They would tie horsehair to it, and with the horsehair, they would tie onto it glass and rock and bone and wire. As they placed Jesus down on his naked back and they tied him to this whipping post, they would dip this cat-o'-nine-tails in a bucket of water that was placed there beside the whipping post. And they would allow it to saturate the leather so much so that it was so heavy it could not be done with one hand. That's the reason why the handle was so long. And they would remove it and all of its weight, and they would hold on with two hands, and they would swing and they would lash it against his body. By Roman law, they deemed that it was humane as long as you stayed within 39 lashings. 40 would have been inhumane, but 39 was within the realm of humanity. And they had a strategic pattern in which they did this to their prisoners. 13 times across the right shoulder blade, 13 times across the left shoulder blade, and then 13 times down the spine. And with all of the things that were attached to the whip, as it latched into their prisoner's body, you did not just flippantly remove it. They would whip this into him, and then they would rip it down and out of his body, so that one lashing looked more like four. And in this moment, Jesus endured all of this pain in the whip. Many men never even made it to the cross because of the destruction that was put on their body on the whipping post. And yet Jesus endured all of this pain as a symbolism in your life and in my life and what we are presently walking through. He paid a price for our freedom. And the whip brought about freedom in our body. It was this symbolism that he put himself in position to experience excruciating physical pain so that he could understand any pain you ever walk through. That our God was willing to experience the worst of pain so that he could fully understand the pain you experience in your cancer diagnosis, so that he could fully experience the pain in every broken bone, so that he could fully experience the pain in every debilitating diagnosis that you get in your life, so that every moment of pain that you physically walk through, he can understand it, and he felt it, and he carried it upon his body. And years later, one of his followers that watched from the sidelines, named Peter, wrote this in 1 Peter chapter 2. He personally carried our sins in his body on the cross so that we can be dead to sin and live for what is right. And then he finished with this: by his wounds, you are healed. By his wounds, you are healed. And you see, I believe with all of my heart, and what I want you to understand is that we have a God who is still capable of physical healing. That the great physician has not closed up shop. But what I also believe is this, is that while my God is capable of healing, he doesn't heal everybody all the time on this earth. And if you're anything like me, the question that comes to mind is why? I don't understand why we don't always get healing on this earth if he can do it. And I don't know the answer to that, other than maybe it's because this earth was never meant to be our home. And yet it hasn't negated the fact that in my life, as I look back on hurtful circumstances, that I wonder why God didn't come through. Many of you know the story of my father being diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's at the age of 55. And just a few short years later, I was 22 years old, him passing away from that diagnosis. And I'd be a liar if I didn't look you in the face and admit that there have been too many times to count where the questions have been raised in my life. Why did it happen to him? Why did it happen then? Why was I forced to go through early adulthood without a father and trying to figure out how to be a man on my own? I don't understand that. And yet I look back at other stories from my father's life, and I look back at a moment in time when my dad was in his early 20s. He went out rabbit hunting with some friends, and he had shot a rabbit in the forest, and the rabbit was still squirming on the ground, and so he got the brilliant idea. He was going to put it out of its misery, and he had saw people do this before where they simply hit the rabbit with the butt of their gun and it kills them. And so he thought, I'll do that. I'm good enough to do that. And he put his gun on safety, hit the rabbit, and the shotgun fired off right into his heart. And somehow, amazingly enough, the way in which the gun had discharged, everything somehow exploded around his heart. And one of his friends that was with him there knelt in that field, and as they called the paramedics, he took off his sweatshirt and he literally stuffed the sweatshirt in my father's wounds. And the doctors, time and time again, for my dad, I don't know how it missed your heart. I don't know how you survived in that field. I don't know how this was possible. And yet I look back and I see all the healing that can only be explained as God and how that possibly happened in that moment. And so much of my life is possible because there was healing in that moment. And yet oftentimes so many of us go through moments in which we don't get the healing we want. And the hope that we have lies here. While we might not always get physical healing on this earth, we have a God who always comes through in eternal healing. A God that allows our hope to be placed in one day because of a relationship with Him, we experience eternity that is void of any pain, any suffering. But we have a God who is willing to take the lashings on His back to speak into your life and my life. No pain you're walking through is something that I have not experienced and something that I'm not willing to walk beside you in. And something you aren't capable of, having hope that I'm a God who's big enough to heal you in that moment. But the soldiers picked Him up from that whipping post. They document that they took Jesus into their private quarters at that point, waiting for their next orders in the crucifixion. And as they took Him into their private quarters, they began to mock Him and humiliate Him. They begin to pray on this title that had been given as the King of the Jews, most likely because they were jealous. We want to be the rulers of the Jews. We want to be the King of the Jews. And so they found this purple robe, and they attached it around His body and His bleeding back. They placed the blindfold over His eyes. They began to slap Him across the face and exclaim, "If you really are the Messiah, then tell us which one of us hit you." They cast lots for His clothing. And then one man began to braid together the vines of a thorn tree. And history actually tells us that the thorns from the crown of thorns were about 2 inches long. And they pressed the crown down over His head. And what we know is that with thorns that long, not only would there be exterior bleeding that would have taken place, but the thorns would have actually pressed into His skull. They would have started to create this immense pressure, this interior bleeding on Jesus' brain that would have created excruciating headaches in that moment and for the duration of His life here on earth. And in this moment, Jesus was enduring that because He recognized the excruciating pain that so many of us would go through in our minds, that these thorns were a symbolism of the freedom He wanted to bring in your mind and in my mind. Because He understood the debilitating factor that so many of us would experience at the hands of depression and anxiety and worry and fear. That we would understand the havoc that it wreaks in our lives when our minds are tore up. And Jesus said, "I've come to set you free of those things, to provide a peace in your mind that nothing in this world can offer." He said it before His crucifixion in John chapter 14. He said this, "I'm leaving you with a gift. Peace of mind and heart. And the peace I give is a gift that the world cannot give. So don't be troubled or afraid." His punishment was meant to provide you and I peace in our minds from the fear and the worry and the anxiety and the depression that so often closes in on us. And they picked Him up from the floor with the crown of thorns around His head. And they led Him out the doors, and they attached a cross to His back. And the soldiers quickly realized that from His wounds and from His exhaustion, that this man was incapable of carrying His own cross. And so they found a man in the crowd named Simon, and they picked him out, and they attached the cross to his back, and they ordered him to carry it. And Simon and Jesus walked step in step up a hill to what is called Golgotha. And they reached the top of this hill at the pinnacle of embarrassment. And they laid Jesus down, and they went about this very detailed process of how you should crucify someone. There was to be a slight bend in the arms because their goal was not to kill someone by wounds or by the crucifixion itself. Their goal was that the prisoner would die by suffocation. And so they created a slight bend in the arms because there were two ways that you could catch air when you were on the cross. You either raised your shoulders up to catch air, or you pushed yourself up by the wounds in your feet and the nails that were planted there. And strategically enough, we come full circle. The reason in which they decided to lash him 13 times over the right shoulder and 13 over the left is to tear his shoulder muscles, so that he could no longer gather breath by raising his shoulders up. And they went about this strategic process then to nail the nails into his hands. And we know that they classified it as their hands because in Roman culture, from your elbow to your fingertip was your hands. It's the reason why they shook hands like this. And so they nailed it actually into his wrist so that it wouldn't rip loose. And he bore the pain of having his feet nailed into a wooden post and each of his hands strung up. And the symbolism of this is absolutely profound and incredible. Because when you think about it, what do your hands represent? Your hands represent everything you've ever done. And your feet, everywhere you've ever gone. And in that moment, Jesus was enduring the wounds of the nails to set us free from everything we've ever done and everywhere we've ever gone, to give us freedom in our hands and to give us freedom in our feet. And not only was he providing freedom in the way of forgiveness, but he was also making this point. I want you to understand that my forgiveness is unlike anything you've ever experienced or will ever experience in your life. Not only do I forgive you, but I don't hold those things against you any longer. That's how I operate. That's how I work. Check this out in Hebrews chapter 8. And I will forgive their wickedness. That's mine. That's yours. We all have that living inside of us. And I will never again remember their sins. And for many of us, this is a difficult concept to grasp. Why? Because this is not how we operate as humanity. Amen? Within our marriages, we don't operate this way. Like, we say we forgive our spouse, but we're looking for the right moment to bring the wrong thing back to the surface to hold over their heads, aren't we? We haven't been parented this way. As kids, we go out into the backyard and our parents told us not to play baseball too close to the house, and we did it anyways, and we broke the window. They fixed the window and they forgave us, but every time we go into the backyard to play baseball again, you know what reminder we get? Remember that time I told you not to play baseball so close to the house, and you did, and you broke the window? Don't do it again. We don't parent our own kids this way. We're constantly bringing back to the surface. Remember when I told you not to do that and you did it anyways? This time, why don't you listen to me? And God's like, that's not how I operate as a parent. I love you more than that. Not only am I willing to forgive you, but I'm willing to never hold that back over you again, to look at you with a clean slate every time we do this relationship together from this moment forward. But here's what else God realized. He realized that while you may get to a point in which you accept my forgiveness, what you will continue to struggle with is forgiving yourself. And you keep beating yourself up over the addictions and the regrets and the mistakes of your past. And I have taken the wounds so that you can free yourself from that as well. Just a few verses later, in chapter 9, verse 14, he writes this: just think how much more the blood of Christ will purify our consciences from sinful deeds so that we can worship the living God. That I took on these nails so that you didn't have to hold it against yourself anymore either. That was my plan. That's why I was pierced for your mistakes and your transgressions, so that you could begin to experience freedom from everything you've ever done and everywhere you've ever gone. And as Jesus hung on that cross for just a few hours, and he exclaimed, "It is finished." The Roman soldiers stepped back in absolute amazement at how it had gone so quickly. Crucifixion typically took days, and this man named Jesus was gone in but a few hours? And typically they had this procedure that they went through when all the Roman soldiers were tired of looking at this guy up on the cross suffocating, and they began to feel some pity, that they would take this wooden club up to the cross and they would break their legs, because they were no longer, because of the torn shoulder muscles, to get breath like this. It was simply pushing up on their legs. And so they'd break their legs and the suffocation would happen much quicker. But Jesus was already dead. But the way to be sure was the final step of the process. They pulled out the spear, and they would insert the spear right under the rib cage and pierce the prisoner's heart hanging on the cross. And history actually tells us that when they shoved the spear into Jesus' side, a mixture of blood and water came pouring from the wound. Do you know what that scientifically tells us? The moment they stuck the spear into Jesus' body, his heart had already burst. Jesus didn't die from suffocation or his wounds or blood loss. Jesus died from a crushed heart. To communicate into your life and my life, the moments in which your heart has been crushed, mine was crushed to free you from that. The spear was the symbolism of the freedom he brought to my heart and to your heart. To drive home this truth that was communicated hundreds of years before this, that we have a God that heals the brokenhearted and bandages their wounds. God was looking you and I in the eye thousands of years later and saying, I know you've been hurt. I know you've been betrayed. I know you've been stabbed in the back time and time again. I know you felt the pain of losing someone in what feels like far too early for their life or your life. I know your heart has been broken again and again and again, but mine broke so that you could understand no broken heart of yours is ever too big for me. No pain you walk through emotionally is ever outside my realm of healing. That I have come to set you free from that. That no pain is too big for my comfort. But the question that remains is this. Why? Why would Jesus endure all of that for me? Because let's just be honest for a second. I don't deserve that kind of love. That kind of love, it doesn't add up. It doesn't make sense. The very reason that Jesus endured all of that for me is because he loved us way too much to leave us suffering in our own anguish of our mistakes and our addictions and our regrets from our past. That he loved us exactly as he found us. He was willing to come and sacrifice it all and endure it all in the form of a whip and thorns and nails and a spear, to allow us to finally experience freedom in our lives from our past that we could never bring about on our own. To allow us to experience a better future than what we experienced in our past. But the only way in which we get that is if we make the conscious decision right here, right now, to embrace the freedom he has already paid for and stop paying for it ourselves. That's how much he loves us. That's what he has done for us. Are you willing to embrace a freedom that can only be found on a cross? Would you pray with me? Father, this morning, God, your love and all that you endured doesn't make a lick of sense. I didn't deserve that. What I deserved was to wallow in the pain that I chose for myself and my past mistakes and regrets and addictions and slip-ups. But you came to offer me something better. You came to offer me freedom. You endured it all so that I could unchain from all of those things from my past and to step into a rich and satisfying life, to step into a life lived to the full. You paid a high price for that, and that price came with benefits. Benefits that we've ignored for far too long. So God, this morning, I pray for the courage to let go, because you've already let go. To stop paying, because you've already paid. And start walking forward with the freedom that only you can offer, because you love us way too much to leave us where we are. We thank you for that. It's in your name that we pray. Amen.
I was found, for I was lost. I was yours before I was not. You wear the scars from my mistakes. That part just read. Don't deserve this kind of love, but somehow this kind of love is who you are. It's a grace I could never add up to be somebody you still want, but somehow you love me as you find me. You love as you find me, love me as you find me.
Let's all sing and sing this.
Love me as you find me. Your love's too good to. Your love. deserve this kind of love, but somehow this kind of love is who you are. It's a grace I could never add up to be somebody you still want, but somehow you love me as you find me. Love me as you find me.
See, this morning we come face to face with this truth that we've failed to acknowledge throughout this series. And that is, oftentimes in our lives on this earth, the things that are most comfortable and the things that are best for us are very rarely the same things. It's the very reason why a relationship with Jesus Christ is rarely the most comfortable things in our life. It's why embracing freedom isn't comfortable. It goes against the way we've done things and the way humanity has always done things. But we have been called to so much better than the way we've always done things and the way humanity has always done things. The price has been paid for our freedom. Aren't we tired of accepting less than that? Aren't we tired of continuing to pay for it ourselves and beating ourselves up day after day, year after year of our lives? You see, Christ paid a price because his desire was for you to experience freedom that led to a rich and satisfying life, for you to be able to walk forward into something better simply by saying, I'm done. I'm done with all of that stuff, with everything my hands have done and every place my feet have taken me. I'm accepting the power of the thorns and the whip and the nails and the spear that he bore for me, because he loved me so much he was unwilling to have me stay where I was. He wore all of my mistakes and every lash and every scar on his body. That's how much he loved us. And today is the day, and this is the year for us to start to embrace that and walk forward into what he has next for us. Like we said earlier, we couldn't be more excited or feel more privileged that you have chosen to join us on this journey. But next week is a week that, as we close this down, you do not want to miss. We promise you, when we say it is a week that has the power to unlock the door from this moment forward into incredible things, unlike anything else, we mean it. And so next week is a week that you are going to want to make sure that you are here. Again, thanks so much for being here. Have a great rest of your day, and we hope to see you soon.